Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric. I'm here with Michael, and we are doing another episode of Double Feature today.
We are, in fact.
So what's going on with the show?
Today we're going to, unfortunately, we're going to have to get into a little bit of something that I'm admittedly uncomfortable with.
Yeah, this is kind of new terrain for us, but we thought it would be an interesting exercise. And as we fumble through year two and try all these different things, we got another weird thing coming up next week. Stay tuned for that. We're going to talk about vampires today.
We're going to talk about vampires.
And we're going to talk about, I guess we could say, the most notable vampire film of the 90s, mm-hmm. Interview with the Vampire. We're also going to talk about the most notable recent vampire film.
Well, I'm going to go most notable vampire film.
Vampire film, yeah. Ever. Sure. Let the right one in. Now, there's a lot of things we could have done with it. I think we're going to do them in reverse order, too,
yeah.
just so you know. There's a lot of different ways we considered going.
We could have gone all the way back to Nosferatu.
Yeah, we could have done a Bela Lugosi one. We could have done, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula. I mean, that was definitely mm-hmm. a 90s vampire film. We could have even gone with our kind of exploitative double feature sensibility and done something like Blade or Underworld.
Blackula.
Yeah, I mean, those would have been easy movies because we wanted to talk about Let the Right One In. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's get that out of the way. I think a really important film. You would agree
with
me on that.
Absolutely.
And so we're looking for stuff to pair it with. And I think you have to go, you know, it always comes back to notability.
Mm-hmm.
We're always concerned with why things worked, when they worked, and what can we learn from that. So we're going to put these two back to back, and we're going to extensively spoil both of them. And they're both very...
spoilerable.
Yeah, they are. We're going to do Let the Right One In first. If you have to spoil yourself on one, that's not the one you want to do it with. So use the chapters. If you haven't seen it, skip ahead to Interview with the Vampire. And you know what? If you haven't seen Interview with the Vampire, you can skip ahead to the end of the show where we'll tell you about the other weird thing we're going to try next time on the show. I want to start with Let the Right One In, but I got to tell you, I almost feel bad calling it a vampire movie.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is there's kind of a problem with the film in that it's a movie with vampires, not
right.
So much a vampire film.
Yeah, this is a Swedish movie, came out fairly recently.
Yeah.
It's about in that realm of too recent for this show to be talking about.
Yeah, but I wanted to cover it before the Americas kind of got their hands in it and muddied it up and everybody
sure.
thought we were being too artsy by being like, oh, well, you saw the new one. You should see the old Swedish version.
Right, right. Well, and I told a lot of people we wanted to do this one first, and they're like, oh, yeah, because the American remake, blah, 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 blah,
yeah.
blah. And the fact of the matter is, this is a movie that merits conversation in and of itself without even invoking the remake, for better or for worse.
Right.
You shouldn't see this one first just because, and
yeah.
you shouldn't see this one instead, and you shouldn't compare the two. I mean, this is a film that deserves to have an entire portion of the show dedicated
right.
just to it.
Absolutely.
So that's what we're going to do. It is a Swedish film. It's based on a book. And, visual is enough to just wrap me into this thing. I mean, it's got a very cold look aside from the, you know, the
snow.
Yeah, aside from the actual setting of the film. But everything is color balanced, very white. It's,
yeah.
You know, all the stuff outside is kind of bright. But it's a film that's not afraid to be maybe a little underlit.
Yeah.
When it's inside, you know, it's smaller pools of lighting or more minimal lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff is in shadow. It gives it a very kind of dark characteristic feel when it's not, you know, outside in the blinding snow. Either one of those settings work to show off how pale and Swedish our characters look, which I think is pretty cool.
There's the girl that plays Ellie and mm-hmm. the boy that plays Oscar.
Oscar, they're, sure.
For all intents and purposes, that's the film.
Yeah.
There's kind of B characters that are swirling around. There's the whole other
sure.
woman who kind of explores the vampire aspect.
Right, right.
But for the most part of the film, you have these two characters, their children.
The bullies, too, as kind of
yeah.
the antagonists.
But the thing about this film is that you have these two children carrying an entire, what is considerably a fantastic performance by both of them.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, and I completely agree, it's because they're not treated like kids in the film.
No, they're not at all. You know, we, back a long time ago on the show, I think we both made the claim that we've never seen good child actors. And eventually on the show, we found a few here and there. We've been a lot more forgiving, you know, recently. I mean, even on when we talked about shorts, we talked about how everybody was doing a good job, and maybe that was because it's all kids acting against other kids, so it was pretty natural. Here we actually have a story for adults.
Right.
I mean, that's the biggest thing, is to look at the people you're watching on screen. A lot of times, the actors are also the demographic, you know what I mean?
Right.
This is a movie with a couple 12-year-old kids, you know, I think 11 and 12 are both 12. And it's definitely not a movie you would show 11 or 12-year-old
Absolutely not.
Kids.
Well, first off, they wouldn't get it.
Right.
And that's the irony of the casting, is that the film, and this makes the film better, you have these two 12-year-olds who are in a ridiculously mature situation and handling it in clearly in a way that children would handle it. You have this girl, Ellie, who essentially comes out to Oscar as a vampire.
Right, right.
And in an adult world, if these were two adults, the reaction would be fear or laughter.
Right.
In any adult situation,
sure.
Barring, you know, Interview with the Vampire. Because they're children, he just accepts it and he goes, yeah, okay, well, if you're a vampire, that's fine, as long as you'll still be my girlfriend.
Well, and it even comes to a point where she's like, I'm not a girl, are you okay with that? And he's like, yeah, I guess I'm all right with that too.
Right.
In much the same way as we have a story and then we kind of, you know, apply vampires to that story as a mechanic to lend itself to the story, we do the same thing with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
We want to tell a story. We want to tell a story about a couple things. One, about being picked on. I think, you know, being bullied is a huge component of the story. It doesn't get nearly as much sort of screen time as their relationship, but, you know, a huge component nonetheless. But the other story is the two of them.
Right.
It's this kind of bond, this unconditional love, really, that the two of them share, that, you know, nothing really matters. It doesn't matter at all what happens. You know, who the other characters are. Oscar just doesn't have any friends, and here's someone who's warmed up to him.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't have anyone who really knows her secret outside of this guy who's, you know, gone in her life now. I mean, that's the point where they really connect, is after he dies and she has no one now, and she comes back to him.
Yeah, and without jumping the gun, I wanna briefly touch on kind of a question that I have for you.
Mm-hmm.
With that guy that she lives with, who is seemingly representative of a father figure.
Sure,
however,
absolutely.
He acts as more of a servant.
Right.
I feel like this is kind of the, you know, the dying star of what Oscar once was or will be. You know what I mean?
Sure.
As this guy and Ellie met at 12 and they kind of ran off together. And he's kind of, because of his age and because of the realization that he and Ellie will never really become the things that he kind of had dreamed at the childlike innocence of a 12-year-old.
Right, right.
He's kind of just resigned to keeping her alive, and eventually fails in so much that he burns himself with acid
in a gloriously
graphic scene.
Yeah.
And then secondly, in the most literal of ways, sacrifices himself for her well-being.
I'm really glad we're a spoiler-inclusive show, because we get to talk about stuff like this that it would take us 20 minutes to kind of just fucking skirt around so we don't spoil people. But yeah, you are left with this lingering feeling at the end of the film, one of the many unanswered questions this film gives you, and that's one of the brilliant things it does, is where does the relationship go from there? You know, the scope of this film, and we'll talk about that in interview scope, but the scope of this film is very small. A couple weeks or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, however long...
the cut took to heal.
Sure. So, I mean, we're talking about maybe a month. Mm-hmm. We'll just give him a month, right? And at the end, we see her... we see Oscar going away with Ellie.
Right.
So you kind of have to wonder, you know, he's going to age. He's going to grow, and she isn't. But that's completely out of the scope of the film. It's something only to think about. You know, when you watch it again, you kind of wonder... Ellie's guardian, Ellie's father figure, you know, Ellie's past lover, whatever he is, you know, that's the question. What is he? Where did he come from? Is that a role that Oscar's going to take on? You know, is this a really selfish thing for her that she has this bond with him, that she's almost maybe using him because she's going to need someone to take that place? Or did she learn from mistakes there maybe and, you know, something's going to happen in their future? He's going to take on some different role in their relationship, whatever that be.
We have this character who's introduced as basically a big question mark into the film. Where did he come from? Who is he? There's this really, really cool scene that just serves to raise 50 more questions when he simply asks her not to hang out with Oscar one night.
Yeah.
Whether that's him being fatherly, protective, or jealous.
Sure.
This guy kind of ends he's this explosive moment in the film at the ending where, as you said, he's not very good at what he does. He's not very good at being the blood farmer.
Right. Also possible that he's giving up. I mean, just for a second, if I could, you know, kind of indulge this line of questioning we've been going on. It's possible that if we're going to go the jealousy route, that he sees that Oscar, you know, is going to be his replacement and that his time is basically up. He could, you know, it's kind of that the senile bank robber thing, right. You know, the safe cracker, like you've been great at your craft, but in your old age, you're slipping. So he could be almost intentionally fucking up these jobs, right. Not really intentionally, but he just his drive to go out and get her dwindling. Blood and bring it back. Absolutely is dwindling. He could see that, you know, he knows his days are numbered. He knows Oscar's going to replace him. He could just, you know, it can't be an accident that every time we see him do this, he butchers it. Yeah. But sorry, you were talking about effects.
And speaking of butchers,
I always do that.
Let's talk about this film butchering.
Yeah.
Whether it be characters or whatever. But this guy, he has two notable moments of special effects.
Mm-hmm.
One is the acid.
Yeah.
He kind of gives up and disfigures himself by pouring the remnants of his vial of acid.
He knows he's caught.
And the film kind of does this thing where it shows him in his hospital room after Ellie has scaled the wall in one of the coolest scenes of the film.
Yeah, that's another good one too.
But you have him and he like leans out the window and he's got all these like he's got the holes in the side of his face.
Yeah.
And you can see his breath coming out of the holes in his cheek.
Pieces of his face moving. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty brutal.
And essentially he sacrifices himself, leans over and Ellie, you know, feeds off of him and then he drops.
And he fucking hits his head on the way down, too. Just the way these shots play out, they always deliver that one extra little... You know, I think of the scene towards the end where she's fighting the man in the bathroom, and you get that one bloody arm dragging down the wall.
It's kind of the moment where the film, instead of going, and then this is the part where this character dies,
right. The
film goes, this is the frame around where instead of going, and then that guy dies, you instead go, that scene was incredible.
Yeah, you could take one still, one static image from each of these kind of deaths or special effects shots that make the shots iconic, that represent
exactly.
them. You know, when you drew these things out in storyboard, they were obviously done with an icon in mind. And each one of these shots, I mean, that's one of the reasons I mention the colorization and the way it's shot in the beginning. Because, you know, this cold world is very representative, of course, of her relationship to him.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions her body being cold. But then you also have that, which works really well in contrast to the blood. And that's how you can make this blood look so brutal. I mean, if you're blood on snow is an image.
I mean, you and I have had this discussion.
Right. Is an image that we need to exploit further because mm-hmm. it's not being done nearly enough. A movie like Dead Snow, for instance, takes that, you know, in
as title.
But a lot of it revolves around these colors, these kind of whites and then, you know, paler browns or red colors, yellow colors. And then you get the blood and it works in contrast to that white, and it makes it feel more brutal, and you notice it more. This doesn't have to be a bloodbath throughout. That's almost what you expect from a vampire film. You know, when I think of the title vampire film, I think of these are definitely bloody films. They're about blood.
So speaking of bloodbath, not to take that too literally,
right.
But we move into the bad pool scene, which is this. It's the climax of the film.
Yeah.
Oscar is in the pool, and the kid whose ear he's bludgeoned, his brother comes in and kind of he takes the reins over from what these kids, who are still in their own right, horrible little children.
Yeah.
But they will only go so far.
Yeah.
And this kid takes it a step further. He takes it to the extreme where he's either going to disfigure Oscar or kill him.
Yeah.
Is really where this lies.
Yeah.
And he's alone in the pool.
And this is more of Oscar being bullied. He needs to learn to stick up for himself. Right. And here we think Ellie's gone.
Yeah.
You know, this is his moment to... I mean, basically, it's all out on the table. You're going to do it or you're not, you know?
Right. So he's being held underwater. And this is probably my favorite choice the film makes.
Mm-hmm.
The film manages to kind of dance around an excruciatingly violent scene
yeah.
the entire time. You know that they happen. You've seen the fucking inferno of the other vampire woman,
right,
in the hospital.
Well, there's also her. Another scene I really like is you have the early one of her under the bridge. But that's not the one I'm thinking of. Actually, it's the one where she drops from the tree.
Yeah,
it's little sort of unusual, unexpected things like that. It's really creative.
Yeah.
You know, these other different directions it goes, and every time you see the special effects. It's attention to detail. It's stuff that's unusual. When his cheek first gets cut,
yeah.
I mean, it gets cut, the blood slowly appears, and then his cheek actually kind of warms up.
Yeah.
It turns red. Just little stuff like it, kind of seeing her eyes in the darkness,
right.
Things like that. But yeah, you get her dropping down from that tree. You know that this brutality exists out
yeah.
there. You're just kind of taking more Oscar's point of view where you're not necessarily seeing it.
It seems like the film is at first, it seems like the film is kind of like, and I hate using this phrase because I disagree with it even
right.
in practice, but it seems like the film is taking the high road of violence,
okay.
which is the violence happens, but we're above that.
Yeah.
We don't need to see
yeah,
that
yeah.
because we're all adults here. We know what violence is like, and we don't need to lower ourselves to
sure.
the level of voyeuristically seeing these horrible acts.
Neither one of us agree with that, but
absolutely
we're
not.
Aware that that is an opinion.
It's a concept
that exists,
especially
and,
in
right.
a film as artistic as this
sure.
film.
Yeah.
But instead I feel like
we're
it's
above
just,
that opinion of them being above
exactly.
us.
Exactly. So instead I feel like it's them pulling the punches to add gravity to this final scene,
yeah.
which is it is literally a bloodbath.
Yeah.
My favorite choice of the film is that they don't show it happen.
Mm-hmm.
They show, as you said, Oscar's point of view. They show Oscar being held underwater, and you hear the door slam,
right.
and you're like, okay. And you see the feet getting dragged through the water,
yeah.
and you start realizing there's something fucking bad.
Oh yeah,
going
terrible,
on.
Like worse than they could have even shown you.
And then a head drops in the water
yeah.
behind him, and then the arm holding his head just kind of floats off, and you see it severed, falling in the pool,
yeah.
and then. Right as he gets pulled out of the water, you see the blood pools start to form in the water around
sure,
him.
Sure.
And then it cuts to just an objective view of the pool where you
right.
see the three boys' bodies and the one boy crying, but you never see the action. You see the results of the action from the beginning to the end of the scene.
Well, and this is a really good scene to talk about because it directly leads into what I wanted to talk about next. But as a story element, we are aware that there is brutality, but it is so dark that we're told anyways that we don't want to see it.
Right.
This is not something you want to be privy to. It's as I imagine adults would have this, you know, conversation.
Right.
She's going to tell him there are dark parts of my life
right.
that are necessary.
Right.
And I don't want you to even
right.
know about those places. They're so private and black,
well,
you know?
One thing this film does, and I love it for that, and I know you love it for that too, is that it doesn't make death anything better than what it is. Like,
right.
death is as dark and
she's
as
not
bad
any happier
and,
about doing
and,
it.
And
than,
she doesn't
yeah.
like it. She's doing it as a survival.
Self-preservation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And whenever she does it, she feels awful for it.
Yeah.
And the scenes of gratuitous and graphic violence are no easier for any characters within the film than they are for if it were our own family having it happen to them.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of joy in this revenge at the pool. I mean, it should be a revenge scene, right? They've
yeah.
been picking on him the whole film and
sure.
now they're getting their just desserts. And upon rewatches, there is a perverse little part of me that's like, okay, this is the revenge, you know, portion.
Right.
And I always look forward to that, but the thing I look forward to more is knowing from a filmmaking perspective, as a piece of craft, what this does, and it's pretty simple. We've seen this in movies before, but I think it's ridiculously effective here for the you know, dark part of her
mm-hmm.
life that I mentioned previously. But as a mechanic, it leaves, you know, the violence to your imagination, and it gives you enough images to know that whatever's going on is the most twisted.
Right.
You know,
it makes it worse. It
yeah,
makes
it really
worse
does.
Than what
yeah.
actually happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't want to say that because I felt like it was
yeah.
obvious, but that's really those are the words that need to be
yeah.
said. You know, seeing those feet skim across the pool. I mean, you imagine the most awful
yeah.
things in your head. And I mean, you know, for a normal viewer, of course, because this attracts a lot of art house people, even though
yeah.
it kind of borders on horror, especially because of the subject
sure.
matter and the violence. Of course, it's going to be awful to them. But
mm-hmm.
I mean, we've seen a lot of like chopsploitation.
Absolutely.
And everybody on that couch was still going, ah, oh my God. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, the things that are happening. As soon as you see the feet, it kind of takes you a second to fill in the details.
Yeah.
And right as you finish going, oh, the head drops in.
Exactly.
And you just know it's a massacre out there. And that's exactly what the film needs at that exact
yeah.
moment. It delivers better than, you know, a film that might have mishandled that situation. you know, would have given you the actual visuals of the massacre.
So you see all this violence and you become aware of this possibility of a vampire's life being ill-romantic.
Right.
It's not all ponytails and English dandies and Tom
vampire
Cruise
baseball
by the fire.
Right. Okay.
Instead it's dark and sad. And that's one of the things I like about this is the vampire-ism, the vampire legend
mythology.
And the mythology is really dry.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of spelling it out for you, they kind of play around with it. Even when it's stuff people don't know is actual vampire mythology,
right.
The cats, for example.
Yeah.
That's one. Also the title,
yeah.
The Let the Right One In, when True. Ellie walks in without being invited and basically bleeds out.
True. Well, one of several things I think that title could be an allusion to, but I remember that back from, there was a great vampire episode of The X-Files back in the day. And I remember that as being a rule, a piece of lore that's kind of been forgotten or isn't very often
it's
used.
It's ignored because it's not sexy.
Well, you can't look at
fun.
It. It's not a piece of garlic.
It's not a piece of garlic, and
it's not
a
part
steak.
Of your arsenal when you're Blade and you're suiting up.
Absolutely.
Not to put down the Marvel comic mm-hmm. character Blade or anything.
But it's that kind of attention to the subtle parts of the vampire legend.
Yeah, right. In the same way that the film focuses on subtlety. I mean, above all other things, we've talked about a lot of the sort of more minute, meticulous details, and that stuff's really important here. But the thing I cannot stress enough that is my guess, I'm going to throw this to you, is why I think this is the perfect approach. And it's really simple. What this film does is it takes a story and it says, what mechanic can we use to tell that story? We want to tell a story about standing up for yourself. We want to tell a story about confiding in someone.
About
we want
friendship.
To tell. Right, exactly. Friendship above all other things. What mechanics could we use to tell that story? And vampires.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's essentially the idea. You have a story first and you go, you know what a great mechanic would be? Is vampires. So your story elements are there. You're just using it as a mechanism rather than starting with, I want to make a cool vampire flick. You know, how do I fill in the details there? You know, you think of something like the 28 series, 28 Days Later, 28 Weeks Later. You have kind of these different stories you want to tell, mm-hmm. motifs you want to hit on. And you
May
go,
is another good one.
Yeah, absolutely May is. Yeah, I don't know what order those pieces came in there, but when you watch a film like May, it's certain that there are
heavy story elements
that
borrow from a latter kind of horror background.
Right, and that aesthetic certainly helps that story too. Cloverfield is another good one. That's another whole theme we could hit on, you know, for later in the show is doing story first, monster elements, you know, mm-hmm. in the background. And then the other obvious thing being unanswered questions. You know, the things they don't probe in this movie are just as interesting as the things they show you, and you get equal parts of both.
Right.
You don't know what happened before. You don't know what's going to happen next. You pretty much just know the story that's in front of you because that's the scope of the film. That's what's important. You do get a nice little allusion to how they may have money to travel off, so mm-hmm. it kind of explains your ending a little bit. But there's just so many different questions to probe, not even mythology, but just little stuff like how did she come to be? You know, why mm-hmm. why is she there? This whole idea of androgyny and of her not being a girl, which the film pokes at enough to raise the questions, but not to give you concrete answers.
Right.
All of these little details make it, I think, a far more interesting film to watch and to talk about later.
Well, unfortunately, when it comes to talking about things later, we can put this off no longer.
Yeah.
We're going to have to actually discuss Interview with a Vampire after our discussion of Let the Right One In.
So we were faced with two choices here. And we know there's going to be some negative stuff in Interview. And we don't like doing negative shows because you probably listen to the show because you like one of the two movies, if not both. And there are great things to say about Interview. And we'll definitely get to that.
Absolutely.
But as part of this examination, we knew that there's going to be a little bit of trashing Interview in here. Because, hey, we just watched it, and it's a little hokey.
It was kind of the idea with the pairing. Like, the idea when we put these two together is, what is the best vampire film?
Right.
Other than Let the Right One In.
Right.
And we kind of came to a consensus of, well, I guess, you know, Interview with a Vampire. So here's us being kind. Interview with a Vampire without Let the Right One In was, at least at one time, the best vampire film ever made.
Oh, sure. And I'm sure people who haven't seen Let the Right One In will still say that about
it. But the reason that we wanted to pair it with Let the Right One In is because Let the Right One In is a new evolution in not only film, but
evolution's a good word for it, yeah.
In the legend of telling something that used to be hot topic, popcorn, goth kids and their girlfriends were both vampires because bit each other's neck instead of making out.
Yeah, right.
That kind of thing.
Sure.
And that's what Interview with a Vampire really hit on, especially being from, you know, the early mid-90s.
So, yeah, when we look back at the 90s, I mean, this was king. You know, this was king of vampire material. For a long time, Anne Rice, especially before her weird Jesus-y phase, was, you know, that was the golden tome, even more so than Dracula. I mean, people looked at this as the, not to mix my awful metaphors here, why not, the vampire Bible.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because there's more of it, and it's deeper, and you can identify with it more because the characters have more of a body, and they're more attractive, not even in a physical sense, but they're more attractive than Dracula and Helsing and the old camp of Christopher Lee and company.
So to look at this as, for a while even, the only game in town, I mean, you know, most recently, I'm not gonna actually rattle off the names of these because then I would have to tag them and then we would show up in Google under an HBO series and a, you know what, another series that just came out and a movie film series that is very popular. And there's vampire stuff everywhere
now. It's the new thing now.
Yeah, but in the 90s, I mean, Interview for a while was the only game in town as far as like real movies.
Yeah.
Not the shit that we watch, but like movies that people have actually heard of and care
movies
about.
Movies in wide release that it was a big deal even when they fucking came to Blockbuster.
So I have a couple ideas on this, but I was interested in your take. I mean, it reigned as king. Why is that?
Well, I think the clear answer, and we kind of briefly discussed this earlier, is that instead of going vampires are kid stuff, vampires are, you know, they're for immature men or little kids. Like, they're not real and they're bullshit. This film, instead of bothering with whether vampires exist or not, it instead goes, this is a serious film. We're making an actual film. We have big name actors. This film will get a wide release and it's a serious drama. It's the story of a vampire specifically.
Sure,
it's not so much vampires and garlic and vampires aren't the enemy.
Right.
They're the characters.
Well, and also, you know, you mentioned the garlic and stuff. Anne Rice, above her weird issues with everybody wanting to do their mom, and, you know, I can't stand those books. They're very, very fluffy. A lot of filler. But, I mean, she had canon, you know. That's why I've read Anne Rice books.
Sure.
I think that's the thing that people really enjoy about these books.
That's what attracts people to anything with any kind of mass to it. The more you can submerge yourself in a world, the more attractive it becomes because you can kind of gain this understanding of a completely different area.
Right. It's something Tolkien did really well and why his stuff is popular because he created such a large world that there was so much room to put in, you know, story was an afterthought because story is the kind of, not to say there you know, isn't great story there, but there's so much of it. There's so many different stories to tell. When you look at Lord of the Rings, that's one particular story about a, you know, troop of people who have to do something important above all else. But then he had all these other stories in that world. Anne Rice kind of did the same thing. You know, she built this world, she laid down these rules, and you became interested in what stories could be told in that world and
who were the characters, who weren't the characters.
Right, right. And how those rules applied to them, what they did. And, you know, it's an exercise in your own creativity to read those books because I don't know if a single person reads any of the Vampire Chronicles without kind of inventing their own Vampire Chronicle in their head.
Sure.
You know what I mean? They always kind of go, you have to play that game as you read the book because you kind of have to guess where it's going. So you think about the rules, you think about the characters, you kind of wonder, you know, it's part of that mystery there and you wonder what's going to happen next. And she builds those worlds really well. We see the same thing when Interview with the Vampire came to film. Almost exhaustively, it talks about the rules right in the beginning, what's bullshit, and, you know, it mocks the old lore.
Right.
I mean, that's
absolutely,
that's another way to set yourself up is, I mean, it's hit or miss. If you miss, you're going to look really stupid, and in retrospect, maybe it does. But at the time, you go, oh yeah, that Dracula shit, that was dumb. Here's how the real world's up.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you what's really up, you know? But so rewatching this, I mean, is there still a place for Interview, do you think?
Actually, why don't we, I'm going to use the same address you've just given. Like, Dracula, that silly shit, well, here's the real world, but now we've seen Let the Right One In. So Interview, that silly shit,
and here's the real world. Yeah, so it kind of runs that gamut. I prefer to look at this, and this might be a great launching pad into the actual film, but this is a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
It takes vampires seriously.
It takes them seriously.
Which maybe we had back in the Bela Lugosi days. I mean, we're so far removed from that, we'll never know if that was intended as, you know, kind of funny. Probably not, but I mean, that stuff is so old that it's been out of the popular culture. were sort of rebooting vampires in the popular mm-hmm. culture.
And there's like 10 or 11 different camps at this point how vampires should be treated and expanded on. But when Interview came out, like, as you said, that was the one. That was the one way.
Well, remember its predecessors, too. The 80s was littered with, like, funny vampire comedy, even in the mainstream. Sure.
Well, Michael J. Fox, you know, those kind of teen wolf, but sure. with vampires.
Yeah, right. So we're saying, all right, vampires are going to be adults. We're going to tell an adult story. And it's steps like those that maybe we would have never gotten to a film like Let the Right One In if we didn't take that step in that direction. Having said that, we do want to contrast these two. So in talking about this as an evolution, what have we done better in Let the Right One In that Interview could have learned something from?
Well, one,
if they weren't, reversed.
My biggest issue with the Anne Rice vampire is that no steps are ever taken to pull them out of romantic glory. They're always kind of sexy and mysterious and dark.
Right.
And everybody wants vampires. Yeah. It's this weird thing where everybody's kind of a little gay,
right?
And everybody is ridiculously sexy. And that's why the cast is who it is.
Right.
That's why you have Brad Pitt. That's why you have Tom Cruise before he was crazy. And that's why you have Antonio Banderas. Like, that is, if especially
they're all
in
direct combat of the overt homosexual overtones.
Exactly.
We need three big hunks to kind of make you forget that they all have long hair and fingernails.
You need the sexiest. Right. The sexiest aspects of Hollywood, and why not throw in Christian Slater in a stupid Interview fucking
story? So we have to mention that too. What purpose does this? These are, again, quite literal bookends. He's doing, and same thing in the actual book, which annoyed the piss out of me reading it. Why have bookends like this? What does that serve to accomplish in the story?
You know, I think the real answer is so that we can see Lestat driving a convertible.
Is that really all it is?
Or maybe because Louis's actual story has no ending. It ends kind
of. Yeah, it really doesn't.
It kind of, there's like this showdown of fire and a literal fucking reaper.
Yeah.
But it kind of fizzles into, then I saw Nosferatu and the first Superman film.
Yeah, and it's like, well, where do you go from there? And so instead of writing an actual ending for your book, you use this mechanic, which...
Where the quotes end.
Which is almost kind of, I almost want to applaud it for being such a cop-out, It's like, well, then I did a bunch of stuff, and I guess I saw some movies, and, whatever. And Christian Slater turns to me and he's like, that's it? That's all you... it's almost a joke. It's like, that can't be all. There's something bigger. And then they try and, probe these questions of, should you become a vampire? Yeah. Is it a good...
And
which
then,
are also kind of silly questions.
And then there's the fantastic, everybody loves the 90s element of every film could have a sequel.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is how this film ends. It kind of ends... It ends the way that the film began.
right.
With Lestat being like, I'm going to give you a choice.
Right.
But first, I'm going to turn on Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, you would have had an okay place to stop after, he chops up everybody at the vamp, which, okay, so by the way, vampire theater, for all it's worth in this, is one of the reasons I keep the film, aside from a bizarre performance by a really young Kirsten Dunst here. I don't know why I enjoy this so much. I enjoy it really rather than the real film itself, but they go to this, like, almost kind of vaudeville... It's like this avant-garde thing, right?
It is. It's kind
How would you
of,
describe
it's,
that?
It's this weird Art Nouveau vaudevillian, like... It's hard to say whether
it's perverse and challenging theater.
It's kind of it's like Pink Flamingos for the vampire sect.
Yeah, sort
like
of.
you have people who aren't vampires.
No, they're well, that's part of the gimmick, is they're vampires pretending to be people.
No, the people seeing it. I mean.
Oh, no, yeah. No, they're not vampires.
So you have people who aren't vampires, and they're basically walking into a John Waters film, where it starts off with a story, and they're like, I don't really understand where this is going. And then at the very end, the main character eats dog shit, and you're like, I'm not even comfortable with this as a film. I need to leave.
Yeah, that everybody gets up and leaves.
That woman died too realistically for
me. It's this great disguise for feasting for the evening, but also putting on this performance, and I would assume earning money, and it just makes a lot of sense. It's really cool. And then everybody gets offended and leaves without more people clap at Evelyn's presentation in The Shape of Things than clap here. Everybody leaves and they're disgusted and they're horrified. So that's vampire theater, and bravo. But I guess the age of that theater, and talking about this whole Interview section, is the main thing that sort of bugs me, and what I think is great that we've moved on from. The scope of this film is just way too fucking large.
It's gigantic. Like, that is the issue with the film. I mean, my number one issue with the film, actually, is that the film immediately makes a misstep after taking a great step, which is it goes, this is a film that takes vampires seriously. In order to do that, we're going to remove them 200 years so you can't actually comment on how silly this is.
Yeah, sure.
Let's put them in frills and give them all long hair. Not only does that kind of lend itself to the sexiness of it, but it pulls a shroud immediately.
Yeah.
You immediately run into a situation where you go, I can't really.
We talked about that with the Libertine.
Yeah.
It's this shield you put up where it's like, this is a period piece. You cannot comment on how silly it is.
Exactly.
That's how things were back then. They were silly.
Yeah.
No commentary on how silly. Well, the other thing that bothers me with the scope is it doesn't seem like there's an important story that's being told there. It seems more like we're focusing on this interview, so we want to know everything that's happened to these. We want a vampire epic. We start with the idea of vampire epic, and rather than starting with, as we did with Let the Right One In, we want to tell a story. You know what's a really good mechanic is vampires. Yeah. Here we go so far back, and the scope would even be pretty small if we would ended the film like we talked about with the fiery blaze of glory. But then trying to get it all the way up to modern times just seems like, I mean, for Anne Rice, part of that was telling all of Louis's story so we could get Louis out of the way for the first book and then move on, but also to update this to modern times so by the time we get to the third book, we could have vampire rock bands, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which I makes sense or whatever, but the film in and of itself makes this presumption that it's going to be part of the Chronicles.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not a miniseries, it's a film, so it has to work in and of itself. And you know why? Because, you know, another film might not come along for 10 years and it might be fucking retarded when it does, like Queen of the Damned was. So you need to narrow that scope. You need to have a particular story that you're interested in. So rather than the Let the Right One In philosophy of taking story, applying vampires, we take vampires and try to apply story to that. And while, like I said earlier, I think that's a step in the right direction.
Right.
Interview was an important step. I think that small change in the mechanic could have made for a much better film.
And one thing you don't want to do in any film, and this is Michael's filmmaking 101 here, and this means absolutely nothing because the fuck do I know?
Right.
But when you make a film, these are two films to perfectly contrast this. If you start a film and 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes go by, if you let an hour go by and I'm sitting there going, I don't know where this is supposed to
end. Yeah, right. Roadmap. We talk about this all the time. We want to know where
the thing
is.
Like this film kind of starts off and you're like, okay, wait, he's not a vamp. Oh, now he's a vampire. Oh, there's the enemy. And then the enemy dies and you're like, okay, where is this really going?
It's the life and times of Mr. Vampire.
Exactly.
It's the biography
of
a vampire.
And wherein Let the Right One In kind of starts, there's a lonely kid.
Yeah.
You kind of go, okay, that kid's lonely. Once that problem is solved, we will have finished the
film. There's a story arc there. There's a very clear story arc. The place I'm really lost, I'm willing to kind of stumble around and not know where I'm going for a little bit. But by the time Lestat dies and then you're introduced to Armand, I'm like, so this is part two of
it seems like the film has introduced its own sequel halfway through where the story has changed. You've gone from a story arc to kind of like a skipping stone of stories, and that's the perfect analogy because the first arc seems big and important. And then you realize it's not over, so you're less interested and less interested until you just sink.
Well, and there's perfect places for that to go because, you know, we're movie people. We're going to talk about the movie. We've already invoked a book far more than I'm ever comfortable doing on a show. But I think it's important for a couple reasons. And the reason here is that Anne Rice does manage to tie her plot threads for all the things she doesn't do very well in that book. Lestat is important to the Armand part of the film in the book.
Mm-hmm.
In the film, they try and divorce him completely, so you're supposed to forget about him until he comes back. And that just means you have two films back-to-back, which is already the point of our show.
Yeah,
you don't
so
need to make
you.
It the point of your film. So surprisingly, I did have some other questions to ask about Interview, but they're really not that important. That's the thing that bothers me above all else when you compare and contrast these two films, is the questions Interview raises about parenting being a theme, about what are Lestat's motivations and why and how he's using Claudia to make her, make Louis jealous.
They only become important in the Anne Rice universe.
Yeah, right. They're
the
not,
implications don't carry over like they do in Let the Right One In.
Well, because the biggest question of all is, do you choose to become a vampire? Which is not actually an important philosophical question if you don't fucking believe in vampires.
Yeah.
It's a fun choice to play with in the realm of fantasy.
Yeah,
but
we're
it
not
has
gonna
no,
talk to you about it.
Right. It has no real
We're not
physical
watching
implications.
The film anymore.
Yeah. Right.
The knowledge and thought of the film kind of ends when the film ends.
Yeah, it doesn't
it was
linger
a fun
with
ride.
You. It doesn't linger with you at all. What will linger with you is next week's show.
Oh
Before
my
I tell
God.
You what next week's show is. We have a website, doublefeatureshow.com, and an email address, which is doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. I know for many people, Interview is still a big bit. Everyone's going to agree that Let the Right One is the best thing that ever happened.
Yeah,
ever.
You can't. So nobody, that's not even debatable.
Yeah, that's a fact. All right, so there's no arguing with that. But there are still people who haven't seen it or don't compare the two, which is probably
that's
a much
best
better
way to
thing.
Go.
Yeah, I would only recommend watching these two films back to back if you're interested in the
vampire cinema.
Right. Yeah, if you're interested in
the treatment of something like the maturation of vampires over the years.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you just want to have a good time at the movies, this is one of those double features that is a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Because the dichotomy is such that it automatically makes you tear down the last step of the evolution. But if you do want to send us some email about Interview and maybe some things that I would be especially interested in, what you think is really important about Interview that we didn't cover, so send those to doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. You can also leave us some hopefully not too hateful feedback on iTunes.
Three stars or more, please.
Join our, I wouldn't even care if it's one star. Feedback's feedback. Or join our thing on MySpace, or no one's on MySpace. It's a wasteland, but you can join us on Facebook and we'll type you some messages and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing next time on the show?
Next time we are going to do Darren Aronofsky's entire filmography in two easy steps. We're going to cover his first film, Pi, and his fantastic film, The Fountain.
Yeah, we are. This is another kind of experimental thing for us. So we figured, let's just get all the experimentation out right here, and we'll just kind of deal with that. But we'll get to talk about a lot of Darren Aronofsky's signature and how that's grown. Another similar show and kind of the evolution of, you know, just one man's work. Mm-hmm. And
why it's paid off, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.